Taking a look at your pet's health now with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. If you have a question about your cat or your dog, for example, and maybe a little health problem, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It is so nice to be back on this cold day.
Yeah, I tell you what, you've got lots of things to talk about, I know. And one of them, and we'll kind of sprinkle these through the show as we go along, but one of them has to do with some new whole meals out there for dogs. And I thought that was kind of interesting from Mars.
Well, if someone's looking for them, they're not available yet. They will be launched next month. But Mars is a major pet food manufacturer, and they are coming out with a very unique idea for pet food. This is just for dogs right now.
Right.
And it's called whole meals. It's one piece of food with kind of a chewy outside and a meaty inside. The reason why they've done this is I'm sure a lot of people can identify with this, but pets that have to pick up their food and go over to the carpet and eat it, you know, they take a mouthful and they go and lay down someplace and eat it. That's normal pet feeding behaviors, to pick it up and move it. And I call it carpet food, but it's usually whatever's the messiest thing they have to take over to the carpet. The natural position for dogs to consume their food in is to be laying down. Okay. And they even, you know, foraging for crumbs and stuff afterwards. I mean, my dogs snarfle around their bowl and everything to clean up every little crumb. But, you know, and they also using their paws to hold it is, again, a natural feeding behavior. So they've come out with these things that look like a dog, like the typical dog treats, but they're an entire meal, well-balanced meal in a single piece. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what, you know, especially for, oh, like your typical Labrador retriever that eats like a vacuum cleaner, you know, just snarfs it all up and then is belching because they've swallowed so much air. And I don't think they really enjoy their food. This way it slows things down and they'll hopefully be able to, you know, enjoy eating a little bit more. And the nice benefit is it does control plaque. And in their study, and I've not seen any outside, you know, anybody else doing any outside work on this, it says it controls 43% of the tartar build, or 43% of the plaque and 83% of the tartar buildup.
Wow.
So that's better than most of the dental treats and things that are out there right now. So,
and when will that be on the market?
February. And it's going to be at all the big pet food chains that we have in our area here.
Cool. Well, I'll tell you what, we've got lots of callers online, so let's take a call. Jennifer's online from Sun Prairie, so let's go there first. Jen, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a mystery on our hands. We have an 8-year-old neutered male cat, and in the last couple of weeks he's been depressed, quiet, he has some weight loss, and his appetite is down. And we've had him to the vet a couple times now. His urine's coming back normal. He's using his litter box. His blood count is, all the panels are normal. And he's testing negative for leukemia. And I was just wondering if you have any ideas on where we can go from here without spending buku bucks.
Yeah. And it sounds like you already have, you know, done all the typical things that we recommended. One, getting a good physical exam done by your veterinarian. I'm glad you brought this up, because there was actually a meeting of people with the American Association of Feline Practitioners. They called it a Catalyst Summit, to look at why, even though cats are increasing in numbers pet-wise, why fewer cats are actually going to vet clinics. And so we are, you know, as a profession, always, you know, interested in, well, what is it? You know, what's causing this? And you know, sometimes it's as simple as, you know, you can't get the cat in the car or whatever, or expenses and things. But you did the right thing. You got your cat in because you were noticing some very subtle signs, a little bit of weight loss, a little lethargy, you know, just nothing that was quite, you know, like standing out as a, you know, big symptom of anything. One thing that I would be, you know, making sure, if he's got a clean bill of health, doesn't have any heart disease, you know, abdomen palpates normally, lab work is all normal. One thing that I would recommend that you have your veterinarian check into, which can cause the symptoms that your cat is showing, which is quite vague, is pancreatitis in cats.
Okay.
Very different thing than what we see in dogs. Okay, dogs typically start vomiting and have severe GI pain, and cats, very subtle, just what you're describing. Maybe not eating as much, losing a little weight. You know,
okay.
It's a simple blood test, and it's something that they would have to probably send to an outside lab. I know that there is a new SNAP test, a little benchtop test that veterinarians can use in their clinic for feline pancreatic-like immunoreactivity. A company named IDEX is making it. I don't know how accurate those are. That's something that I'm still looking into, because sometimes you can get problems with false negatives or false positives.
So
I think
it's best to send it out.
Send it out if they can.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And get an accurate result. That would be something I'd be looking into. And if that's the case, then you know, the way this is treated is usually bland diets, intestinal-type diets, pain control, because these cats are uncomfortable, and this can be one
that's
of the signs of pain.
That's what I was going to bring up. My vet was going to try, we were just going to do pain meds for a week, can see if that's showing him, you know, to be a little bit better than we know.
Yeah. And so the one that I like to use in cats with intestinal pain or pancreatic pain is one called buprenorphine. It's a drug that you can use sublingual drops. You just kind of put drops in their mouth as close as you can to under their tongue. It gets absorbed. It's just a matter of a few drops. Doesn't have a lot of GI upset. Some of the other drugs that we use, like the classic non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. There's one that's labeled for cats on the market called meloxicam, but that can upset their tummy and make them vomit and be upset, so that may aggravate the symptoms.
Okay.
So I'd, you know, be talking to your vet about buprenorphine.
Okay. Great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Appreciate the call very much, Jen. Martha in Muscadet, it's your turn. Hi, Martha.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I have what I hope is a quick question. Just for introduction, we have a 20-year-old diabetic cat.
Oh, you've done wonders then.
He's doing really well. But we feed him this Purina Veterinary Diet DM.
Yep.
And he loves it, which is great. We just give him, you know, free access to a bowl of food at any time.
Mm-hmm.
He has adopted a young cat friend.
Okay.
We do not have any idea of the age of this cat, but I would guess he's full grown, but he's still very young, very kittenish, energetic cat.
Okay.
He loves the DM.
Yeah.
He does not want to eat anything else.
And you know, it's not that bad to have him eating that. I mean, my preference would be to have him eating something else, primarily for your pocketbook, because
the
diabetes diets. The unique thing about the diabetic diets for cats, and there's two of them on the market, the DM that Nestle Purina makes, and then there's one that sometimes, you know, other veterinarians will use, although it's not actually labeled for diabetes use, is called MD, metabolism diet, that the Hill's company makes. But they're both high protein diets, very, very low in carbohydrates. And that's one of the issues with cats that are diabetic, is they have a hard time dealing with carbohydrates. And so the protein for many cats that become diabetic, when they go on this diet, their weight will normalize, their insulin requirements may decrease, and in fact, for some, it may even stop. And this is the type of diet now that a lot of cats are going on for weight control, because it does help support lean body tissue. The nickname we give these diets is the Catkins diet, pardon the pun, but you know, they are true carnivores, and so having a carnivorous diet like this does make sense. The reason why your new cat likes this is it's an extremely palatable, very high protein food. So is it going to hurt him? Probably not.
The only reason I've sort of been concerned is his age, which we don't know.
Yeah.
And I tried him on kitten chow at first thinking, well, he's small, maybe he's still growing. And I don't think that's the case. I don't think he's getting any bigger.
Have you taken him into your veterinarian for a physical evaluation?
Yeah, and he's had all of his shots.
Does he have his permanent teeth in? Are all his teeth permanent?
I think they are.
Okay, well, that, you know, once they are usually all in by the time they're 6 or 7 months of age. And so if they're all permanent teeth, he may just be a small adult.
And if he's still under a year, he's fine on this as opposed to something like
that. It won't hurt him. And in fact, if he's neutered, we typically get them off of the high-octane kitten food and onto an adult cat food at or about the time of neutering anyways.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't think there's anything here that's going to hurt your cat,
okay,
but it's just, it's a little pricey, and try to get them off to something else, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Martha. Wendy in Oshkosh, your turn now. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, I have a 7-year-old neutered Shiba Inu male, about 25 pounds, who's a freaky, freaky dog. I've had him since he was a pup. I finally got him on Prozac, which he's responding well to, but he's still real freaky. He doesn't hide under the dresser anymore.
Okay.
I mean, he comes out, but if he hears a noise, he still goes right under there, and he attacks other dogs. If we're at the dog park or something, he'll try to attack, I mean, huge dogs.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, he was on amitriptyline, which had some bad side effects, so we put him on Prozac, 10 milligrams twice a day. Do you have any experience with, I mean, I'd like to see him respond a little bit better. I've tried, you know, socializing him and taking him to classes, but I think...
Yeah.
Any other experiences with any of the other anti-anxiety drugs used in dogs, or could we up that dose, you think?
Yeah,
or?
Well, Prozac, the generic fluoxetine, okay, it actually is now labeled for dog use. Lilly Company, the iLilly Company, has come out with a version of fluoxetine for dogs. It's a once-a-day drug, okay? It is not a twice-a-day drug. And the dose that we typically use it at is a milligram per kilogram. And if he's a 25-pound dog, that means he's probably about a 12-kilogram dog. So he's getting almost double what he needs if you're using it twice a day. So,
whoa.
Yeah, so I would double-check to make sure that you truly are using fluoxetine.
It is fluoxetine.
It is.
Yeah, I get
okay.
It from
okay. Yeah. It is it's a once a day drug, and once a day, but it takes about 6 weeks to have any benefit, and I don't know how long he's been on it.
He's been on it for about 3 months now.
Okay.
And he definitely has shown a benefit. So is it toxic then that he's on
well,
a high dose?
You know, anytime we put a dog on psychoactive drugs, we always want to make sure that you're working with a veterinarian that's monitoring lab parameters, and I typically get them in once they've been on it for a month or two and, you know, redraw a liver panel, make sure everything's healthy and happy and not having any troubles. And so if you haven't been in recently, I think it's time to do that. But if he's on that high level, it may not be the appropriate drug for him. A couple of things that are, may or may not help, but I think it's always worthwhile looking into. Number one would be, get one of those new DAP collars for him. I don't know if you're familiar with dog appeasement pheromone, but for dogs that are anxious, some of them do better with that. It's a kind of a natural product that the dog walks around in this pheromone haze that makes them feel more comfortable. May not notice anything, but it won't hurt. So I think it's worthwhile trying for a month to see if it makes a difference. Other thing is, when we have dogs that are, there's been very few studies on nutrition looking at behavior, but there was one that was published a few years ago looking at protein level in the diet and the effect on behavior. And what they found is that dogs that were fearfully territorial, fear-related territorial, and that was the one thing that they found. But I think anytime you've got a fearful dog, and it sounds like your dog maybe if it's hiding under the dresser and running away and things may have a strong fear component, it's always worthwhile trying to play with the diet. And what they found is that feeding a diet approximately about 19% protein on a dry matter basis, which is much lower than what you're going to find in many commercial dog foods. You're going to have to go and very carefully be looking at dry matter evaluations. That may take your veterinarian actually pulling out, feed guides to be able to find it, because that's not always published on the bag. But feeding a lower protein diet for some of these dogs, because protein's used for making some of the neurotransmitters, this may be helpful. And I think it's always, one of those simple solutions that may be worth trying.
And so a lower protein diet.
A lower protein diet,
okay.
Yeah.
19%.
19%, about that. And so if you can find in that range, that would be great. The last thing I want to do is get up on my soapbox here. Not all dogs can go to the dog park. And if your dog is giving other dogs a hard time at the dog park, I'm one of those owners that would be all over you and saying, your dog should not be here, okay? Although you may be thinking that you are, and am I getting a little red in the face here? Sorry. But I see on my end of things as a professional, so many dogs that go to the dog park that get injured because someone has taken their dog there and they said, oh, we're trying to socialize them. That's not the place to do it, okay? Mm-hmm. Because those dogs that are there, they're having a good time. They're not therapy dogs. And as a result, you may be inadvertently creating dogs that have more problems at the dog park. And if your dog is anxious at the dog park, you may just be adding to the anxiety by throwing them in with these dogs that may not be behaving in the appropriate way.
Yeah.
And so I think it's great to try to socialize your dog, but if your dog has a problem, work with a certified animal behaviorist that may have a fleet of what I like to call therapy dogs that will not say boo to your dog, whatever they dish out, and your dog can be controlled effectively, and you can correct the behaviors and encourage the appropriate behaviors rather than doing it in a public area where dogs can be, other dogs can be traumatized.
Yep.
So I don't take my dogs.
I do keep him on a leash, actually, at the dog park. I don't let him just run.
Yeah. But he's still,
Do you think Shiba Inus are just weird dogs? I mean, are they weirder than normal dogs?
Can I tell you my nickname for them?
What's your nickname?
Japanese murder dogs. Okay. I hate to put it that.
Japanese murder dogs?
Because I have been... They go after me. The few that I have as patients are freaky in the exam rooms. A lot of owners have the same kind of complaints that you have, that there's a lot of, you know, behavior issues. And I know there's going to be Shiba Inus out there. Like, I have a perfect dog. But, you know, I've just seen a lot of problems with them as a breed. So
there you have it.
Yeah. So sorry to put it that way, but that's my kind of behind the scenes nickname. Now it's out in the open. But, yeah.
Wendy, thank you very much. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And Sandy, there were one other comment I think we could make on that.
Yeah, I still haven't gotten down off my soapbox. Sorry.
Poor Wendy.
But, I think, you know, the final comment that the last owner made that had the Shiba Inu that's going to the dog park is, well, I'm responsible because I have my dog on a leash. But remember, if you've got a dog that's fearful or dog aggressive on a leash, that just makes them, they're like a sitting duck, and that will often aggravate the aggression and the behavior because they may be feeling trapped. Sometimes it's the information that is going down the leash from the owner. So there's a little phrase that I like to use is your dog listening to the jerk on the end of the leash or the jerk on the end of the leash, okay, meaning the human, okay? Mm-hmm. So because if you're pulling back because, oh, a big dog's coming, that information that you're sending down that leash to your dog could be just aggravating the problem as well. So again, this would be something that you really, if you've had this much trouble, you really need to be working with somebody. Drugs alone are not going to solve a dog's problem. You really need to be working with a behaviorist.
Ann in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling for my son. He has a Doberman that has a hard time going to the bathroom, and they had two different vets, and they've been putting it on different diets, and they just don't want to do surgery on it, so we were just wondering what you thought about that.
Well, when you say go to the bathroom, are you talking defecating or urinating?
The colon part.
The colon, okay.
Yeah, they did check it out and everything. It seems like when the vet does an exam on it, it really squeals when they put their finger in there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then when he leaves it outside, it always tries to, go to the bathroom.
Okay.
So they did change the diet. They did give it like hamburger and rice, and he's been trying different things. And they just don't know what to do because they don't want to give it, the surgery, which would cost a lot of money.
And I'm not sure what surgery, if they were unable to find anything truly wrong with the dog, what surgery you're talking about. Did they give you a diagnosis as to what's causing the dog's problem?
No, they haven't. They just took a bunch of tests and they just don't really know.
Okay. I think that, I'm not sure what's going on with the dog. It may be that your son's dog has a rectal stricture. I don't know. How old is the dog?
It's 3 years old.
3 years old. Very unlikely that there's a tumor or anything like that in there. But strictures are always possible.
Now, what's a stricture?
Like scar tissue, shrinking it down so that the rectum doesn't expand as it normally, or the anus doesn't expand. Sometimes we'll even see dogs with chronic anal sacculitis, the anal glands that sit on either side of the rectum can cause the dog to be painful, and they may not want to defecate if they've got a lot of inflammation back there as well. I think that if you're looking at, you know, making the dog have smaller stools to make it easier to come out, then you're looking at sometimes diets that are what are called low residue diets, similar to like the hamburger and rice that your son was using, but going with a well-balanced therapeutic diet that several of the, you know, big pet food manufacturers make. There's one called ID, another one called Low Residue, another one called EN. They've all got names that, you know, have to go along with intestinal tract issues, but that might be something to consider. The other thing to consider trying would be a stool softener. And don't start using human laxatives in the dog. There are some safe things that are out there, even things like, you know, adding an extra fiber, like a Metamucil type fiber that will help hold moisture to keep the stools a little bit softer. It sounds kind of counterproductive to add more fiber, but sometimes the type of fiber you use will help keep the stool softer. And there's other stool softening agents that can get used, and that may help the dog feel a little more comfortable. But yeah,
He was going to call the breeder once and see maybe if it would be in that, you know, relation of the mother or something, you know.
Doesn't sound like this would be something that would be genetic, and you know, maybe time to, you know, go back to the veterinarian and just say, you know, you were mentioning surgery. Well, what are you, you know, what are you actually thinking about doing? And it may be that they're talking about removing the anal glands, and that may be part of it. So, yeah.
But then he said it also gets the diarrhea. Besides, you know, like sometimes it'll get the diarrhea and then it'll have a really hard time going. So it's kind of back and forth.
Yeah. And, you know, dogs that have colitis, inflammation of the colon will go out and strain as well. And it's like it's continuing to burn even after a small bit of stool has come through there. And so having this patient, if the veterinarian has not done kind of the routine workup for treating colitis, that would be another thing to be looking at as well. But I think one of the problems is you can't give me enough of the information that I need to give you a diagnosis. And so we're kind of going around and around here. Maybe get your son to give a call.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good luck. Thanks a lot, Ann, for calling. Appreciate it. Melissa in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a cat who has an injured tail.
Okay. Okay.
And I am wondering, he is not a cat that goes to the vet easily.
Okay.
So I'm wondering if it's something that absolutely needs to be seen, or...
What did he do to his tail?
Well, that's a complicated question. I'm not sure. He came home from the vet that way.
Came home from the vet?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Did you call your veterinarian and ask if anything happened while he was there?
I did, and the person that I spoke with didn't think anything happened, but she was going to investigate.
Okay, okay. Is your kitty, what makes you think the tail is injured? What's going on?
Well, he when he came home, he had had sedatives for the procedure that he had done there.
Uh-huh.
And his tail was dragging.
Okay.
And so I thought it was just the sedative, so I didn't, I wasn't alarmed at first.
Mm-hmm.
But then after the sedatives wore off, a good 48 hours later at least, his tail is still dragging.
Huh.
On the ground. And
what did he have done at the clinic?
He had an ultrasound.
Okay.
And now it is improved. He can lift it probably about 75% of normal.
Okay.
But only to one side.
Okay.
So it just curls to the side now.
Yeah. It sounds like he's had nerve damage or something done to his tail when it just hangs flaccid like that.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he have an ultrasound done?
He was having some problems with blood in his urine.
Okay. And so they were evaluating his bladder and I don't know, when you say he has problems at the vet, whether he's fractious, if, you know, he was, you know, did he, you know, jump, bang himself, you know, do something at all? And this would be something that not talking to just the receptionist, but actually talking to the veterinarian that did the procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And there should be, you know, notes in the record or whatever regarding this. But, you know, my own dog used to love to, he's since passed away, but go down the slide at the park with kids, and he'd climb up and go down the slide. And one time went down and must have banged his tail, and he lost his wag. And it's a real common injury. In fact, some Labrador retrievers and different dogs that do a lot of swimming will jump in the lake, and because they use their tail as a rudder, they strain it so much that it just ends up hanging flaccid because they've damaged or irritated the nerves. Mm-hmm. And it eventually comes back after a few days. But if it's, this is not associated with any...
And this is a cat.
A cat, yeah. Mm-hmm. So if it's not associated with any incontinence, meaning like he's able to urinate and defecate normally, and he's walking normally... It, you know, it may just be that he either, you know, during recovery, maybe he did a backflip or did something, you know, perhaps in his carrier, got it, you know, caught in the door, you know, there could be any number of things. Talk to the veterinarian and just see, because this would be something that they need to know about, if especially if the injury occurred, you know, at their facility. Mm-hmm. They,
right.
They should be checking this out for you, even though it may be hard to get him in. It may be necessary to.
So do you think if it is recovering, do you think it is necessary that it...
Yes, and so most of the experience I've had with pets that have had temporary tail function loss for like minor injuries, like I described, the dog swimming, we don't know what happened to your cat, they do recover. You know, cases where cats have been hit by a car and have had fractured pelvis and, you know, lower back, they may not recover. But, you know, in this case, it sounds like it may have been just, you know, something, some bruising, some trauma that may have happened inadvertently, and he's, it sounds like he's recovering. So, but I still think it'd be worthwhile talking to the practice owner.
Sure. Yeah, I intend to talk to them. I was just concerned that if I don't take him in, that he might have some sort of permanent damage that could have
right.
been
yeah.
avoided.
And he sure. still may, but, you know, I think he's recovering, and it sounds like he's right on schedule for doing the recovery the way it should be.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Melissa. Tom and Madison, your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Just wanted to call and suggest something. My cat, when it returned from the vet after general anesthesia, experienced some of the same things, paralysis, slight paralysis in one of its hind legs and tail, along with some other symptoms that led me, as well as the vet, to believe that it may have suffered a minor stroke.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, after talking with other pet owners and so forth, I found that that's not that, unfortunately, uncommon after general anesthesia in cats. And I just wanted to mention that and bring it up and see if I could get a comment on that.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling,
yeah,
Tom.
Yeah, first of all, I you know, general anesthesia, even in a perfectly healthy animal, there's or humans, there's always risks involved. And it's you have to weigh out the benefit versus the risks. And for the majority of them, anesthesia is a extremely safe thing. And I have to say, after 28 years of practice, having an animal wake up with neurologic damage is uncommon. Okay. So I'm not sure who you're talking to and where they're getting their statistics, but, you know, I work at a clinic that has a phenomenal anesthesia department. And I think some of the things that we do that, and really any veterinarian does, is before they anesthetize an animal, you always want to do a physical exam. And if it's an elderly patient or a patient with underlying health problems, getting, you know, minimal database to make sure that they're healthy and happy and normal, that they don't have a heart murmur, that their blood pressure is normal, that their kidneys are functioning normally, that, you know, they don't have any abnormal clotting problems or anything like that, before you start jumping in and doing any procedures that would, involve anesthesia. That would then let us know how safe the procedure is going to be and whether we should be proceeding or not, depending on the status of the patient. So I don't think it's that common. Do we see vascular accidents in cats? It can happen. Probably the most common reason why we'll see acute hind end paralysis in a cat that may involve both legs or one leg is a problem secondary to a heart problem where they get clots developing in the chambers of their heart, and one of those gets dislodged and will cause what's called a saddle thrombus, which is a blood clot right where the big aorta, the main blood vessel, bifurcates and supplies the blood supply to both hind legs. You'll get a, just like a saddle on a horse, kind of filling that area. And it can cause, depending on which side it's on, more one side versus the other. And that may be what your cat experienced. So I'm wondering if your cat does have some type of underlying heart disease or something that maybe went undiagnosed and now is there, now that you've had some evidence of an injury.
Yeah, that's possible.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Tom, for calling. Appreciate it. Bob in Wauwatosa, it is your turn. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Larry and Dr. Sawchuk. And before I ask
my question. Dr. Sawchuk, it's great to have you back on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be back.
What a treat. I've got a couple of questions regarding our 7-year-old English Cocker Spaniel.
Okay.
And my first question is, I'd like your opinion, Doctor, on our practice for about a year now of substituting either cooked meat, fish, or fowl, depending on what we're having for dinner. And that would be about 6 days a week. Substituting one of those for a portion of Towser's dinner each evening. We substitute about a fourth to a third by weight of meat, fish, or fowl for his regular dog food.
Okay.
And would just like your opinion on that. My second question is maybe related. How do we tell when it's time to reduce the protein content of his food? I understand from general reading that as dogs get older and you're supposed to reduce the protein content, and I've looked at some of the senior dog foods and they seem to be lower in protein. And how do you tell? Is there a blood test?
No.
Or what?
One of the few diseases that requires, there's a couple of diseases that require dogs to have lower protein, and primarily kidney disease, but also sometimes liver disease. That's really, I don't want to call it a myth, but for many senior dogs, if you start protein depriving them, they will start utilizing their body muscle mass, and they still need protein. But if they have underlying renal kidney disease, you can give them better quality of life and prolong their life by feeding them protein levels, and it's usually high quality protein, but lower levels of protein in some of these like kidney friendly diets. For most of the senior diets that are out there, and again, it's being able to read pet food labels correctly. You're going to find that they're not a protein restricted diet. They may be a little bit lower than your performance foods and so on like that, but they're not protein restricted. They tend to be lower in calories because a lot of dogs, as they get older, are less active. Many of them have added glucosamine and things like that to help protect the joints. May have extra antioxidants to scavenge free radicals. But the protein level is not usually touched that much. It may be slight, but it's not going to be like the real truly protein restricted diet. Back to your first part of your question regarding substituting some meat in with your dog's diet. I'm going to go through kind of my rules of feeding table scraps to not, and these aren't scraps, okay, but I'm just my rules of feeding table scraps to dogs. Number one, it needs to be high quality stuff, and it sounds like that's what you're doing.
Yes,
you're not
always cooked. Also.
Yeah, good. Okay, so you're not feeding the pork chop fat and
no.
the chicken skin and grease
no.
or anything like that. It's what you're eating, and it's cooked. Great.
Right.
Okay. It should not be associated with having the dog be a moocher. If they are coming to the table and mooching, then you got a problem and you're continuing to perpetuate it. So they can't be moochers.
Yeah,
their weight has to be normal, okay? We don't want to be doing this to an overweight animal. So if your dog has a normal body condition score of 4 or 5 out of 9, and that would be something your veterinarian could tell you by evaluating your dog's physique, then, adding extra things in on top of the diet is probably not going to be of big consequence. Can't affect the dog's GI tract either. If it gets diarrhea, gas, anything that could be a problem, then obviously we need to stop those things as well.
Yeah, all systems seem to be go.
Good.
His weight is real stable. His weight hasn't varied more
good.
Than a half a pound from 35 pounds.
Perfect.
Since he was a year old.
And the last thing of Sawchuk's rules of feeding table scraps is that it doesn't make up any more than 10% of their diet, because by adding in that extra protein, you're actually throwing off the mineral composition. The meat that you're feeding is really, too low. I mean, it has no mineral in it. It doesn't have any calcium or phosphorus or anything. And so you're throwing off the dog's food balance by adding in this, a lot of meat. And so potentially, could you be causing your dog a problem down the road? Yes. What I would be, and it's probably going to be minimal, but if you really want to be safer, cut it back a little bit rather than having it be a third of the diet. You know, maybe no more than, well, I'll give a little bit here, 10, maybe 15% of the diet. Okay,
no, that's a fourth to a third once a day.
Yeah, yeah.
That we've been doing.
Yeah.
Is that too much?
It probably is a little too much. So, you're throwing the balance off.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Good luck, Bob. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. All right. More callers online. Let's go to Mike in Langlade County next. Mike, hi to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
And I second the last caller's evaluation of the doctor's appearance on the show.
Oh,
okay. Thank you.
I'm in the market for a new puppy, and apparently some things have changed about vaccinations, so I would like to have you tell me what should the puppy have in the way of vaccinations at 7 or 8 weeks when I pick it up, and then what's the vaccination protocol thereafter?
Oh, what a good question.
Yeah.
One of the things that you can do is if you want to really educate yourself, you can go to American Animal Hospital Association's website, okay? And it is it goes by the initials AHA, A-A-H-A, and I think it's .org, but I know that there's a porn site that uses those same initials, and I've gotten into trouble when someone's gone on to do aha.com. So be careful, Larry. He's typing it in the computer right now.
Must be .org.
Okay, it must be .org. But they have the guidelines published on there, and so that might be a good place for you to look. But in a nutshell, what it comes down to is understanding your dog's life cycle, or lifestyle, I should say. And this would be something that with working with your veterinarian, knowing where your dog's going to be going, disease prevalence in the area that you live is really going to be helpful. A few things that at the 6 to 8 week mark, all puppies should be vaccinated. 8 weeks, I like to see them get a distemper, parvo vaccine, Adenovirus 2, okay, that would be what are considered the core vaccines. They're too young for getting a vaccine called leptospirosis. We like to wait till they're about 12 weeks for that. So that may be given on the next vaccination schedule, next visit. But we will vaccinate with the distemper parvo combination, usually 3 vaccinations, 8, 12, and 16 weeks. But it depends on the life, you know, the life of the pet. If it's in a pet store, it's going to be at higher risk. Or if it's in a rescue center, they may want to vaccinate more frequently, every 2 or 3 weeks versus every 4. If your dog's going to be a swimmer in the water, out in the field a lot, around wildlife, then adding in at 12 weeks of age a Bacterin called leptospirosis, and that's usually done at 12 and 16 weeks of age. If your dog is going to be in a high Lyme endemic area as well, and we are seeing more and more tick-borne diseases. Number one, practice good tick control, but talk to your veterinarian about the incidence of Lyme disease in your area. And again, it's not a core vaccine, but Lyme vaccine, we usually start, I typically use it here at the 12 and 16 week visit. It's labeled for use as young as about 9 weeks of age for most of the vaccines that are out there, but it's just for convenience, we'll use it at the 12 week visit. And then lastly, rabies kind of depends on your local ordinance. In our area, we can use it anywhere from 12 weeks and up. I typically give it on the 16 week visit and give rabies on that at that point. And lastly, kennel cough vaccine. This is Bordetella bronchoseptica. It's kind of like our whooping cough bug. I think all puppies should get it because if you are going to be getting them out and socializing them, getting them to doggy training classes, boarding them, doing anything like that, that is required. And we usually do that either on the first or second visit. Typically, the first visit is when it's done. So,
okay.
Yeah. I don't know if that helps, but
thank you.
Go to that website and make sure you have your puppy's stool sample checked when you get in, because that's a big thing, too, is and automatically have them taken care of. Almost all puppies carry roundworms. And so even if the stool sample comes back negative, your veterinarian should still be instructing you to use something that's going to get roundworms and hookworms. And that may be the heartworm preventative that they get put on, or it may be a separate drug that they are given every couple of weeks until they're 10 or 12 weeks of age.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling. And that's A-A-H-A, .org.
Yes.
.org. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. We'll go right back to the phones, and Bob in Eagle River, I believe, is up next. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Good morning. Good morning. Two questions. One probably is not answerable, so I'll save that for the second part.
Okay.
The first one is, years ago, the Humane Societies, when you adopted a kitten, would give you like a $75 voucher towards spaying or neutering. And now it seems like before you take the kitten out, they want it spayed or neutered at a very young age. What is the appropriate age for that for cats?
Oh, this. Thank you for bringing this up. And, you know, the reason why this change has been made is that when they went back and looked at statistics of pets adopted from humane societies that were unspayed or unneutered, and just you were told you can come back and get it done for free. You just got to bring it back and we will take care of it for you at, you know, 5 or 6 months of age. 50% of them didn't get it done.
Oh.
And then they would add to the pet overpopulation problem. Mm-hmm. So as a result, they, even though you may be very conscientious, 50% of the adopting population out there isn't. So we have taken that away from adoptive parents and said we need to get them spayed or neutered. And for, you know, for cats, spaying and neutering as a young animal, you know, 8 weeks, 7, 8 weeks and up, there is really no recognized health risks. I know that there are people that say, well, you know, it's going to cause urinary obstruction, that there's been no evidence that early age spay-neuter affects the diameter of the urethra, what they urinate through. So that's an old wives' tale that's been perpetuated. What it does do is it alters their metabolism. They can get overweight and have issues. So you have to be a little more careful about watching diets and things. For female dogs, though, one of the things that they're recommending is waiting until the dog gets to be at least 12 to 16 weeks of age, because there is a strong link between really early age spay-neuter and urinary incontinence. And so they're waiting to do that surgery a little bit later in shelters. And so you may find female dogs are going to hold longer before they allow them to be put up for adoption. But that's the reason. Mm-hmm. So if it's being done, that's great. The shelter's right on the ball.
All right. Thanks, Bob, for calling. Mark in Racine, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
Welcome back. I'm a man who believes that angels do truly walk the earth, and I think you're one of them.
Oh, thank you.
Well, certainly. I have a dog who's a rescue dog. He was formerly abused. I think he was abused as a component of partner abuse. And he's very defensive of my wife and pretty much ill at ease with any human being besides my wife and loves any other dog. I was wondering if there was any kind of therapies we could use to lower his anxiety without disinhibiting him.
Oh, yeah. Well, good question, because a former owner or caller called talking about different psychoactive drugs. And when you've got a dog that's really fearful, there's certain classes of drugs, mainly like the drugs that fall in the Valium family, the benzodiazepines, that can take away their inhibitions and they may be more inclined to be aggressive. So we tend to avoid using drugs like that. You know, and it may be that your dog wasn't abused in the, you know, saying that, you know, beaten up. And when we use the word abuse, think physically.
There's almost no doubt that he was.
Maybe he was. But sometimes, I mean, I've seen dogs that are only know that humans come in one package and that's female or male. And it's just that they were, you know, very poorly socialized. And so they don't know how to react around men because they are taller and their voices are deeper and so on. I'm not sure what you've done to try to have the dog be more comfortable with you. Big thing is don't push yourself on the dog. You know, tossing treats to the dog, avoiding eye contact, you know, having the dog be brought into the room while you're sitting down and, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. First thing in the morning, I come down, I get a cup of coffee and pick up a newspaper and get interested in that. And then I can kind of approach him diagonally from without looking at him, you know, kind of back up and sit down next to him. And after a while, I can touch him. He'll initially flinch, but then he relaxes a little bit. But I can only touch him with one hand because two hands means I'm trying to grab him.
Yeah, yeah.
And he, if somebody comes into the house and walks up and hugs my wife, he bites her. He bites them, you know?
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And so yeah. he's a fear biter, and he is a defense of my wife biter.
Wow, wow.
And I don't know.
you may need
been
to get
with
some
us
professional
for a
years.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and a couple of things that you know, one, I think you really do need professional, not maybe you, but your dog needs professional help. Yeah. Well, you both do, you know, because that's the big thing when you get behaviors coming into your home. So much of what we're doing is not only working with the dog, but training the owner how to react to the dog. And you've even, one thing that you've said is that you're able to approach to a degree, but then the dog still flinches when you go to touch him. You shouldn't even be touching the dog at this point. If you can't even, I mean, you want the dog to be relaxed and only go to the next step of contact when the dog's in a relaxed state. So you may be perpetuating this fear by continuing to, oh my God, he's coming up to me, he's going to be touching me. And you know, if he's already flinching. So that's where a trainer is going to be able to help you go step by step to desensitize the dog to touching and you approaching and doing it the right way. And it's not the easiest thing to do, even though on paper it sounds easy. It is something that I always defer to the professionals for something like that.
Can you recommend a professional in the Racine area?
That would be something I'd be talking to your veterinarian about because,
okay.
You know, there are all different levels of trainers from, you know, a true certified animal behaviorist to, you know, people that are, you know, more obedience type training. And I think in a case like this, you know, obedience is always helpful. It gives your dog something to do. They can be, you know, on a sit stay and that gives them something to occupy their mind and, mm-hmm. and so on. But you need more than that. And I think, you know, you may be having to work with both types of people. But,
yeah.
You know, talk to your veterinarian to find out who would be a good one to be coming to. And you may have to travel a little ways, even maybe, you know, come up in this area or even, you know, northern Illinois to be able to find somebody that's going to be well qualified.
Sure.
When it comes to medical management, yes, I mean, typically the first drug I would try in a patient that's like this would be one called clomipramine. It's a tricyclic antidepressant that has anti-anxiety effects, and it'll start kicking in a couple of weeks. But that's usually my first drug of choice to give that one a try.
Mm-hmm.
But
clonipitrine?
Clomipramine. Okay.
Clonipramine.
Clomipramine.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a brand for dogs called Clomacom.
Okay.
And you know, so there's one that's actually labeled for dog use.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Good luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark. Thanks a lot for calling. And Daryl in Cumberland is next. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, good morning, you two. How you doing?
Good.
Fine, thank you.
I got a Boston Terrier, and he is really gassy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I've got, he was on Iams,
mm-hmm.
but then Iams almost killed him with that bad food.
Okay.
Because he got really sick on it and lost a lot of weight, and then he wouldn't even touch the Iams.
Okay.
And then we put him on a science diet, and he gobbles that up.
Okay.
But he's gassy.
Okay.
And I know Eukanuba, which I know they're an offshoot of Iams, but they have I guess they're coming out with a breed specific for Boston Terriers.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, actually, I have two English Bulldogs at home, and so I can sympathize with the aroma of dog in the house. And the reason why your dog may be so gassy is because they do a lot of air swallowing. These brachycephalic breeds are the ones that have this pushed-in nose are going to be swallowing more air, and it's got to come out somewhere. May also be make sure you've got a good, you know, bill of health, that the dog doesn't have giardia, get a good, you know, intestinal parasite evaluation, because sometimes that can result in a lot of gas problems. Look at how you're feeding your dog. Sometimes feeding them from an elevated position, they'll swallow less air. So, you know, get one of those little raised up areas that you can use, you know, things for your dog. And lastly, make sure your dog isn't overweight, because obesity can sometimes cause dogs to be gassier as well. And then looking at just what you're feeding, it may be that the fiber type is inappropriate for your dog as well, and you've just got too much fermentable fiber that's causing problems. And so just switching from one diet to another, you know, may or may not help. It depends on the fiber type that they use. When it comes to the breed-specific formulas, I've had very good success with using a bulldog formula for my dogs. It's designed to be, it looks like a giant Frito, and they, and so it's they have to chew it. It slows their eating down. It's easier for them to manipulate in their mouth, so they're swallowing less air, and it's got an anti-flatulent property incorporated in it, so we have less problem with a little, you know, that is a problem. So I'm not familiar with the one that Eukanuba Company's coming out with, but a lot of them have a lot of science behind it, and they're designed, you know, they are mouth texture and ingredients-wise designed specifically for certain breeds, so it's worth trying.
Alrighty. Well, thanks. That's encouraging.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot. What's the name of that food that you use?
That I'm using, it's by the company called Royal Canin. They also have many breed-specific formulas out there as well.
All right. Thanks a lot, Daryl. Appreciate the call. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking your pet's health now with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Dr. Sandy, you were talking to me before the show about a website, the Fort Dodge website, that has some pretty good information for cat owners.
Yeah, it's if you want to go online, it's all one word, all lowercase, www.healthycatsforlife.com.
Okay? Healthycatsforlife.com. Okay.
And it's a website that they've come up with to bring to the owner's attention one of the things that they have in there, which I thought was excellently done, is 10 of the subtle signs of illness in a cat. Because cats are masters of hiding things until the end, or, you know, until things have really progressed. And it's things that owners can just be watching for. Simple things like not using the litter box may not just be a behavior problem, or they don't like the litter. It could be a problem to, you know, not grooming, changing their interactions with the owner, activity change. How many people think that? I mean, I thought this when I had an older cat that suddenly became more active. Oh, isn't this great? He's happier. Turned out he was hyperthyroid. And, you know, and so even if a veterinarian can look at these behaviors and miss them temporarily, but he did get diagnosed, you know, change in the sleeping habits. If they're up and wandering at night and meowing, I mean, sometimes we'll see cats that are vocalizing more that are hypertensive, high blood pressure, and they've got a headache, and so they're meowing. Or, you know, these are all little things that you know, you add up to, you may have a cat that's sick. So, you know, read through that. Another cute little page on how to get the cat in the carrier. You know, they talk about the best design of a carrier. And, you know, whoever initially manufactured cat carriers that have the door in the front that is tiny, that you have to shove the cat through, we're idiots, you know. And the new ones that we're seeing that look more like a clamshell that open up or have access through the top, wonderful. Those are the ones that we like to see cats come in at, because then we can open it up and not have to, you know, try to extract the cat from the carrier. They go in easier and they come out easier. Yeah, makes it everybody happier. And, you know, just little tips on taking your cat for car rides so they don't think that going to the vet is the worst thing in the whole world. You know, they get to go in the car and come home, and boy, nothing happened to me. So, you know, just a cute little website for people to look at.
HealthyCatsForLife.com.
That's right.
All right. Well, let's go to Bush in Milwaukee next. Thank you very much for calling. Hi.
I appreciate you taking my call, and good afternoon to both of you.
Good afternoon. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I've had German short hairs, Weimaraners, basically hunting dogs, and I've been plagued in the past with fatty tumors.
Okay.
Is there a breed of dog that has less fatty tumors, or is the fatty tumor in one's diet that causes that? Please help me.
Neither. Okay. It's not diet related, because we can see slender dogs that will develop these benign masses called lipomas. They just happen to be probably one of the most common type of tumors that dogs will get. They're benign, but they can be problematic if they're located in areas such as the armpit or on the chest wall, where every time the dog lays down, it gets irritated. For the most part, it's more cosmetic than anything. And it, you know, you've got a lot of, you know, it sounds like you have active short-haired dogs, and so they may be more of a problem than, say, a long-haired dog where they're going to be protected, or you just don't see them as much. But it's rare to find a dog that's a senior citizen that doesn't already have one or more of these on them. It's just, they're that common. And they're not affected by metabolism. So if you were to take your dog and put them on a diet, these blobs of fat that are located under the skin are not going to be affected. And they're going to stay there. The dog may lose weight in other places, but those masses will stay the same. So,
May I ask one more question?
Sure.
In your professional opinion, does it make sense to have them removed?
Only if they're bothering the dog. So I had a dog in the other day where there was one right on the dog's sternum or breastbone.
I see.
And
okay.
Every time the dog laid down, this thing would bother the dog and it would have to shift and it got inflamed and the skin was irritated over it. And that was the case where we removed it. Had another one in not too long ago where it was up in the armpit. And when the dog tried to run, it would bother the dog. And actually, this was a dog that was a therapy dog and had to wear a harness. So not only was it bothering when the dog was running, it was right under where the harness worked. And so we had the dog in and had it removed. And the dog is now much happier working without that lump there getting irritated. So
last part of my question, if I could. To your knowledge, are there short-haired hunting dogs that are less prone to get fatty tumors?
Not that I know of.
That's all I wanted to hear. I appreciate your answer.
Okay.
And I'll go out and start looking for a couple of new dogs.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. Lana in Madison, your turn. Hi. Thanks for calling, Lana.
Yes. Hi, Larry and Dr. Sawcheck. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My 85-year-old mother, who has beginning Alzheimer's, is we're trying to put together a trip for her to go to Baton Rouge with my brother. And after my dad died in 2005, in 2006, she got a cat from a shelter. And we had the experience of a year ago of bringing her from La Crosse to Madison. And my mother gets very traumatized by the cat meowing and having what she considers a terrible time traveling.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, do you have any suggestions for how we can successfully get this cat by car from La Crosse to Madison and on Northwest, which apparently will take cats?
Okay.
To Chicago and then to Baton Rouge.
Okay. I don't know how long she's going to be gone for.
A
month. Okay. I would, if the cat is that traumatized, I always think that cats are such creatures of habit.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any possible way the cat can stay in its home environment, mm-hmm. and have a pet sitter come in a couple times a day to feed it, brush it, play with it, clean the litter box, make sure that gets done. That they typically
the best,
do better doing that,
mm-hmm.
rather than transporting the cat.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way of having this? Yes, we can, manage the cat's anxiety medically. And this would be something that the veterinarian that's been working with the cat would know whether the cat would tolerate sedatives or other types of anti-anxiety drugs to make it an easier trip for everybody. If the cat is going to be going in the baggage hold, though, on the airplane, there is no way that this cat should be medicated.
Right.
And there are temperature embargoes in the winter. If it's below 40 degrees, your mother would have to sign a waiver, mm-hmm. that the cat can turn, be out in the cold for an extended period of time. But if it's, it's going on the airplane, again, there's nothing worse than the crying baby flight or the screaming cat flight,
Right.
So you may be looking at, again, are there some safe drugs that can be used? But I think in this case, if it's only a month, rather than having the cat go through all of this, get used to being down there, and then reverse it and come back again, try to leave it at home if you can.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And if she refuses to do that, is the pheromone spray a possibility?
Right. Thank you for bringing that up. I talked about it with dogs earlier. It's called dog appeasement pheromone. The cat one, called Feel Away, mm-hmm. sometimes known as comfort zone for cats. Don't get the dog product. It comes in a spray bottle. You can spray the inside of the carrier, and
right.
that may be helpful. And again, making sure that the carrier is comfortable for the cat to be in. It's going to be able to fit under the airline seat. That may be something that would be helpful. And again, the more time the cat can spend just hanging out in the carrier when it's in the home and just there as a fixture in the living room, it may not become such a scary place for the cat,
mm-hmm.
as well. So try to introduce the carrier very early.
Okay.
Right, and you say, I can check on healthycatsforlife.com regarding just, the new type of carriers.
Well, they just talk about, you know, the design that we like, the top, you know, the top loading, just to make it easier for cats to get in and out. You are going to have to, though, follow the airline regulations, and they have very strict, you know, carrier guidelines as to what can fit under the seat.
Uh-huh.
Follow what the airline is recommending.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank
you very much for calling. Yeah, this especially with mom with Alzheimer's and having to handle the cat and carry the cat.
I know. And the cat, although I think it's kind of wrong, you have to pay for the cat to be on the airplane.
Yeah.
And the cat is considered your carry-on luggage. So no carry-on luggage. You've got the cat instead. It can be traumatic for everybody all involved. So.
So Bobby in Stoughton had a question about rabies, wondering what, in your opinion, is the proper procedure if a feral cat bites a person and draws blood? Do you believe the cat should be just be observed for 10 days, or should the cat be put down and the brain checked for rabies?
Oh, you know, in a case like this, I have to say that I'm an advocate for the human involved. If this is an unowned cat that is, you know, it is unowned, then, you know, and I, you know, ideally, that's the only way to check for it is to have the head sent in. Obviously, the animal can't stay alive, and that is what's recommended by, you know, in the rabies compendium that we as veterinarians follow, is to have, if the animal is available, have it checked for rabies. If it's owned by somebody, the 10-day quarantine, yeah, you can do that. But you'd probably want to be talking to your physician about doing rabies post-exposure inoculations as well.
Paula in Eau Claire, we turn to you now. Hi, Paula.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a one-year-old West Highland Terrier that's wonderful, appears quite healthy, but ever since she was little, about once every 3 weeks to a month, she will vomit what appears to be yellow liver bile,
okay,
yellow clear liquid. We have had her into two different vets. They did liver tests to be certain there was nothing wrong with her liver. She was on three different diets to find one that she was willing to eat, and she doesn't eat wonderfully, but she does eat, and she can appear perfectly well in between.
Mm-hmm.
And then this just comes out of the blue.
When does it happen? Morning, middle of the night?
It can, not in the middle of the night, we haven't noticed it, but it can happen any time during the daytime. It doesn't seem to be an anxiety factor, you know, because she isn't, like, running around a lot and then she vomits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can just literally happen out of the blue. And
okay.
We, you know, this has been going on ever since we got her.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
In between, she seems fine. She's a very smart, wonderful little dog.
Okay, okay.
But, you know, yeah, we don't know where to go.
Yeah, and it sounds like you did the right thing. You went in and are having, you know, workup done. And, I mean, and there's a whole range of things from getting x-rays, ultrasound, you know, you could, you know, work her up to the hilt. If she's healthy in all other regards, one thing that I would recommend if it hasn't been done is that she go through a broad-spectrum dewormer. There's a parasite that lives in the stomach called Physalopteria that can cause intermittent vomiting. And it's easy enough to – it's hard to diagnose, but easy enough to treat. And so talk to your veterinarian about going through a round of a broad-spectrum anthelmintic or dewormer.
This is something beyond just the normal puppy worming, then?
It might be, because sometimes we have to go longer for, you know, at different levels, and so this would be something I'd have your veterinarian talk to you about. The other thing that comes to mind is there's a condition that is called bilious vomiting syndrome in dogs, and it's, you know, we think that it is almost like reflux in people, just some of the small intestinal contents reflux up into the stomach, irritate the stomach, and up it comes, which is why it's kind of this bile-colored material.
It's never any food connected.
Yeah, and that may be the key to this, because we seem to see this more when the dog has an empty stomach. And a couple of things that I recommend we try is multiple little feedings a day. I don't know how many meals a day she gets.
Well, we just leave the food out. Like I said, she is not a wonderful eater.
Eater, so okay.
She eats basically about at lunchtime and about supper time. She doesn't eat until she sees us eating.
Okay, okay. So, you know, you're leaving it out. That's great. You may find that there's something you can put on it to make it a little more palatable so that she does eat more regularly so she doesn't have an empty tummy at times. Sometimes just having them have a dog biscuit or something small in their stomach just helps things go in, through in the right direction. For some of these dogs, they've responded very well to a drug called Reglan or metoclopramide. It's an agent that keeps everything kind of moving in the right direction, and it also helps the sphincters of the stomach as well, tighten those up so that you have less reflux. I've had some patients that have done well on things like Pepcid, which is available over the counter, but you'd want to work with your veterinarian regarding finding the right dose for your dog. I've had a couple of patients that we've even put on a drug called Prilosec, which is, you know, for people that have reflux as well. So, you know, those are just some things to be thinking about, but it is a very common problem in dogs. And, you know, most of the time that we see this, if you've ruled out other things, keeping them with a little bit of food in their tummy, you know, all the time seems to make all the difference in the world for them.
Just one last question. If she is on a special diet, can she still have dog biscuits?
They do. Many of the pet food manufacturers that make specific diets for health problems will have either canned varieties of food available that match it, or sometimes even some of the dog biscuits that are out there. I know Nestle Purina has come out with one called Gentle Snackers right now. They almost, you know, they look like a little white cracker. And, you know, that would be something that may be compatible with, you know, various intestinal diets. So, again, you check with your veterinarian what they have in stock or what they may be able to order for you.
And thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Melissa in Duluth, your turn. Hi, Melissa. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 2.5-year-old neutered cat. I got him from a shelter when he was 5 weeks old, and right off the bat, he had quite a lot of problems, pneumonia and worms, and the minute his permanent teeth came in, he was diagnosed with stomatitis.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Which means he has the bloody gums and the fascia in the back of the mouth. And basically, I've had him to five vets, the last vet being a board-certified veterinary dentist in Oshkosh. And it looks like at this point we've gone through so many different medications and interferon and lysine and microlactin and antibiotics.
Yeah.
Sort of at the end of my rope, and all the teeth would have to be extracted.
That's the treatment. That's usually the treatment if everything else fails.
Which is many thousands of dollars, and I'm not going to go that route.
This condition that your cat has is called LPGS, lymphocytic plasmacytic gingivitis stomatitis. So, and we don't really know what causes it. It may be viral induced. We think that it may be that the cat's developed an autoimmunity to its own plaque on its teeth, and they're just totally plaque intolerant. It's an very frustrating disease to treat. It sounds like you are doing everything, and I don't have any other suggestions for you except start saving your money, because these cats do phenomenally well when the teeth are removed. It's a big thing. You're going to probably want to stage it and do it, at different times, but their mouth is so painful. You can't brush their teeth comfortably. They can't eat dental diets comfortably. And I think you have been given correct advice. So, unfortunately.
There you go.
Sorry.
Sorry, Melissa. But thank you very much for calling. Tom in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, wants to know what you think about Irish wolfhounds. He's been waiting 20 years to get one, and now he's considering actually doing it. Says, I know this breed requires special consideration before purchasing one. Are there some health issues?
Oh, well, they're kind of like the gentle giant. So they're big. They're huge dogs. And being a giant breed dog, they have their own kind of unique health issues. They don't live as long as some of the other dogs do that are smaller breed. The bigger the dog, the shorter the life expectancy. Things that I'd be looking out for would be, making sure that the parents are screened for orthopedic disease, hips and elbows. That's, definitely they're more at risk for having something like that. Because they're a large breed, deep-chested dog, you know, more prone to problems with bloat. So, you know, getting into the habit of 2 or 3 meals a day, and, you know, sticking with that is a habit for them as well. Other than that, I mean, I think that it's primarily orthopedic problems and the fact that they don't live as long.
Yeah.
And, you know, visit my rule of thumb is always visit with mom and dad. Take the time to visit with both of them and make sure that they are emotionally sound. You know, do your homework regarding, you know, what testing has been done on those dogs. And, you know, be careful with which puppy you pick from the litter. You know, you don't want to grab the shy one or the real outgoing one. Try to find a nice middle of the road one. And, you know, working on, you know, making sure you're using a large breed formula. The breeder would probably have one that they like to use, so that you slow the growth down over an extended period of time rather than having the puppy get pushed to grow too quickly. And hopefully you'll have a healthy, sound dog for a long time.
Sounds good. Nick in Green Bay. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I've got a 70-pound black lab, and he's just an awesome dog. He's 3 years old. But ever since he got older, he's been chewing his pads. It wouldn't be so bad, but you hop in bed, and all of a sudden it's the wet spot.
Oh.
It's funny when it's on the wife's side, but when it's on my side, it's not too funny.
Oh.
So he chews on his paws.
He licks his feet and chews on his feet.
Yeah, and he gets the yeast infections in there all the time, and I was wondering how I can
get him to stop this. Most likely this is secondary to being allergic. We get
allergic.
Yeah, so we get allergies, we get hay fever, dogs get allergies, they itch. And treating the yeast is just going to kind of get rid of what's perpetuating the problem, but you're actually looking at what can we do to be dealing with the allergies. Talking to your veterinarian about allergy testing, definitely I think it would be worthwhile if the dog is plagued and really uncomfortable to find out what he's allergic to, and maybe follow up with allergy injections.
Okay.
Sometimes if it's just the feet, you can treat those medically with like topical steroid sprays to keep the inflammation under control. Special dermatologic diets that are low allergen diets may help some of these dogs as well. And then, you know, treating the secondary infections. And when it comes to treating yeast infections on the feet or on the body, we're looking at usually 30 days of special antifungal agents. So it's involved.
The thing is, ever since he moved down from Michigan, he's been allergic. When we were up in Michigan, he is fine.
Yeah.
Well, and the only real quick other question I got for you, and I'll just take off the air, is you said that you earlier in the show you said that black labs or labs in general usually just wolf down their food.
Yeah.
He is a very, very picky eater, and we took him to the vet because we were kind of concerned about his shape, and she said that unlike the owner, he's in perfect athletic condition.
Perfect. Perfect. Glad to hear it. Nice to end on a note like that.
Oh, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Sandy, in about 20 seconds, what about this new flea business out there?
Oh, there are so many new products that are coming out. And, you know, I'm going to a big meeting next week. And I will be back in the show before flea season starts to talk about all these new products that are out there. There's even a flea pill that lasts for a month that's very safe.
Ooh.
Which will be very nice for people that don't want to use chemicals on their dog.
Thank you, Sandy, very
welcome.
Much. We'll look forward to your next visit next month. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest, and a big thanks to her for being with us, and she'll be back next month, and we'll do this all over again. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to take a look at eagles just a little bit. Randy Jurewitz of the Department of Natural Resources and Jeb Barzin, our old friend from the Ferry Bluff Eagle Council, will be along to talk about bald eagles and Eagle Days at Sauk City and Prairie du Sac coming up this weekend. And then the president and CEO of Verint Energy Systems talks biofuels and bioenergies. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.